listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of In Plain Sight by Adam Leith Gallner. Shorer retried the image search, using the name of the painter's best-known disciple, his nephew Berent Averkamp. Within a few moments, a thumbnail appeared that matched the photocopied reproduction in his file. "Bingo!" he exclaimed, zooming in. As he'd suspected, the painting had been falsely ascribed to an Averkamp follower. Berent's works were inferior to his uncle's, and worth substantially less, but also easier to peddle without drawing attention. Shorer clicked on the thumbnail, which brought him to a website called pixels.com. "That's insane," he muttered to himself, eyeing the screen. Reproductions of the pilfered Averkamp were being sold as decorative throw pillows. For $18.40, anyone could buy a pillowcase with the Stoddard's long-lost icecape printed on it. The machine-washable coverlets weren't the only products that featured the painting. The company's print-on-demand technology meant you could get the Averkamp on a yoga mat, a coffee mug, a bath towel, or an iPhone case. The original was last seen in 1978, before digital photography existed. So how, Shorer wondered, had Pixels.com gotten access to an image that could be reproduced on products? There was only one answer. Someone must have scanned it recently. Shorer looked closer at the on-screen pillowcase. The underlying rendering, he noticed, belonged to a collection called Bridgman Images, a digital fine art archive. For $39, Shorer was able to license a full-resolution version of that parent file. Opening it, he checked the metadata and spotted the initials LSFAL, which he recognized as referring to Lawrence Steigrad Fine Arts Limited, a New York Old Masters dealer. Shorer knew Steigrad well enough to call him. As the telephone rang, he wondered if the Averkamp was still in Steigrad's possession or if his gallery had already sold it. When Steigrad picked up, Shorer got right to the point. "Larry, why are you effing trafficking in stolen paintings from my museum?" Steigrad was emphatic that he'd never bought or sold the painting. He'd simply photographed it when it had been on sale in 1995. "Where?" Shorer demanded. "At the European Fine Art Foundation Fair, TEFAF," Steigrad replied, "a highly reputable art market held annually in Maastricht, the Netherlands." "Every painting sold at TEFAF undergoes a rigorous vetting process overseen by experts, conservators, and academic specialists. Because this painting had been submitted as a Berent Averkamp, it did not receive the same scrutiny that an Hendrik Averkamp would have. And from what Shorer could tell by the high-res scan, the artist's monogram-like signature, which superimposed the initial H over an A, appeared to have been forged. Someone seemed to have etched the initial B over the H. Either way, it was the same painting that decades earlier had been purloined from the Stoddards. Unfortunately, Steigrad informed Shorer, the gallery that had represented the Averkamp at TEFAF was now defunct, and the owner had died. But through Art World connections, Shorer says he implored one of the gallery's former partners to divulge the name of the individual who'd sold them the Averkamp. His name was Sheldon Fish. What I do is I look to find lost masterpieces, explained Fish, when I reached him in Lima, Peru, a proclamation not unlike those I had heard from Shorer. I've made a lot of major discoveries. When not rooting around for sleepers, Fish is the CEO of a South American cargo shipping company that transports hazardous substances and dangerous materials, particularly explosives and radioactive goods. Throughout our call, Fish was adamant that he had not known the Avercamp was radioactive at the time he'd purchased it. When you buy thousands of things, every now and then one of them ends up being stolen, he offered breezily. Believe me, if I knew or if I thought it were stolen, he meant, I would run the other way. Searching Fish's name online brought up reports of a theft of 18th-century artworks from a Peruvian church. Eight of the stolen paintings were allegedly consigned by Fish to an Iowa auction house, whereupon they were seized by the FBI. At the time, Fish denied knowing that the works were stolen. No charges were laid. Asked to comment, Fish noted that the sellers had given him a receipt. You must always be careful who you are dealing with and get a signed receipt. Anyone who knowingly buys a stolen painting is an idiot. During our conversation, Fish had initially told me he couldn't recall where he'd found the Avercamp, though he did speak openly about having profited from it via the galleries that brought it to TEFAF. I sold it for pretty good money, $100,000, he claimed. I remember the painting, but I don't remember who I bought it from. I wish I could be more helpful, you know. It'd be great to help. The more we talked, the less fuzzy his memories became. Upon first encountering the painting, he remembered, he could tell it was valuable. I knew I was onto a score, Fish said. But he didn't sell it to me as an Avercamp, obviously. Who was the he who'd sold it? Fish couldn't recall. To prepare for our interview, Fish added, he'd ask his brother about the painting. The two of them often went treasure hunting together, and his brother thought they'd found it at Brimfield Antique Flea Markets, a half hour or so drive from Worcester. You go from one booth to the other looking for the mistakes, Fish explained. Different experts are running around all over the place, like lunatics, trying to find a lost whatever it is. By the end of our conversation, he'd concluded that he likely found it at Brimfield. I'm fairly certain I got it from there. He told me he didn't have a receipt. Still, Shorer now had a piece of the puzzle. Brimfield. Digging deeper into the events at the Stoddard's home and the ensuing investigation, the sleuth noticed a curious connection. The only quasi-lead from the police investigation was a call Stoddard had received not long after the burglary, during which a voice with an indeterminate foreign accent claimed to know where the paintings were. And though the cops never identified the caller, they were able to track the call to a phone booth next to the interstate, 10 minutes from Brimfield. In a photo by Diana Marcosian, Raider of the Lost, Shorer, with a statue of a Song Dynasty deity in his Provincetown house, the property overlooks the bay where the Mayflower made its first New World landing. One of the sellers' booths at Brimfield during that time, Shorer learned, had been operated by a local antique dealer named Robert Cornell and his wife, Jennifer B. Abea Cornell. 20 years after the 1978 Worcester heist, the two had become suspects when the Pissarro from above the Stoddard's mantle turned up at an auction house in Ohio. Both Cornell and Abea Cornell were questioned by the FBI. Robert Cornell denied all involvement, and no charges were ever filed. The artist's great-grandson, Joaquin Pissarro, noticed the auction listing, and realizing where the painting had come from, personally alerted Helen Stoddard. Her husband had passed away in 1984. She informed authorities, and the FBI moved swiftly to seize the artwork before it could go under the gavel. it had been expected to fetch up to $2 million. It might now be worth 4 or 5 times that amount. At the time of the raid, the FBI began investigating how the Pissarro had ended up in Ohio, but they never managed to reconstruct the painting's trajectory. Cornell and Abea Cornell, by then divorced, had contradicted each other's statements to authorities to such an extent that the FBI described attempts to establish the truth as being like beating a dead horse. The couple had lived 22 miles from Brimfield in a 30-room Victorian mansion called Amesmith. Cornell ran a gallery from their home, where works by Picasso and Chagall were on offer. A specialist in coins, particularly in detecting counterfeits, he fell on hard times in the early 1980s after he was convicted of receiving stolen property. He complained that law enforcement were trying to depict him as the biggest fence in western Massachusetts. Initially found guilty, he was later acquitted on appeal. But the fallout from the trials and several tax audits eventually forced him to shutter his gallery. When the Stoddard's Pissarro surfaced, Cornell denied having had anything to do with it, or the original burglary. "I've never seen that painting," he declared in the Worcester Telegram. "I can say that and be lying through my teeth, but the bottom line is that painting has never been in this house." Abea Cornell claimed she'd found the painting in Cornell's closet, wrapped in paper. She also insisted that earlier it had been mounted on a wall in Amesmith. The couple's acrimonious breakup was compounded by Abea Cornell's involvement in a reported love triangle. As she informed investigators, she and Cornell were working the antiques circuit when, at a Cleveland coin show, she got romantically involved with the owner of a nearby wine bar. Abea Cornell did not respond to requests for comment. Cornell died in 2013. When the couple split up, Abea Cornell allegedly took $30,000 in gems and rare coins from Cornell. He called the police, who promptly found most of the stolen goods in her possession. 4 rare coins worth $10,000, however, were missing. She was forced to reimburse Cornell that amount and served 2 years probation. Media reports at the time stated that she pleaded guilty to avoid a trial and permanent record of conviction. "Without means to pay Cornell off," she told the FBI, she turned to the owner of the wine bar. He acknowledged in the telegram that he then raised the funds to lend her. She said she brought him the Pissarro as collateral. Cornell disputed this, contending that she was attempting to frame him. For a variety of reasons, including the fact that their dueling accounts lacked hard proof, the FBI dropped the case. In November 1998, a month after the Pissarro was seized, Helen Stoddard passed away. The work, depicting a coastal harbor in Dieppe, France, was returned to WAM shortly thereafter. According to reporter Frank Maggiera, who covered the heist for the Telegram and spoke with all the parties, Abea Cornell's account sounded more credible than Cornell's. "He struck me as being a very surly, suspicious person," Maggiera recalled, "a shady antique dealer. Even so," he added, "we don't have any real smoking gun that ties Cornell to this, other than Abea Cornell." Without any strong evidence, the entire Pissarro affair seemed to dissolve into a haze, not unlike the snowy backgrounds of Avercamp's finest midwinter scenes. Shorer had underestimated his initial assessment of the Stoddard's Avercamp, that it would take only 15 minutes to run to ground. He chalked this up to what he called his arrogance. But he didn't stop seeking its whereabouts. Its online reappearance had opened further lines of inquiry. To begin with, Shorer tracked down Abea Cornell. He claimed that she provided him with 2 addresses where the other remaining stolen paintings might have conceivably been stashed. He told me he'd hired a private investigator to poke around. He also endeavored to establish who had purchased the Avercamp at the 1995 art fair. A breakthrough came when he tracked down the descendants of the now-deceased gallery owner from TEFAF. "I come in peace," he wrote. Even so, he added that the FBI has shown a willingness to take a heavy hand in this case. The gallerist's daughter did not answer his initial queries, but Shorer was persistent. After all, he'd been informed that the gallery's records were in her garage. Months later, she agreed to search the archives. If she could unearth the sales receipts, they would likely identify the Avercamp buyer. Shorer was patient. He knew time was often on the side of the tenacious sleuth. Moreover, he had another case he was running down about another Dutch painter. This one was Rembrandt Harmenshoorn van Rijn. In the fall of 2021, Shorer acquired one of the deepest sleepers he'd ever seen, a circa 1629 portrait of an elderly gin-nosed man, seemingly by Rembrandt. It had been put up for auction in Maryland as an imitation in the manner of. The estimated sale price, $1,000 to $1,500. After a bidding war, Shorer won it for a healthy $288,000. If real, that would be a fraction of its value. Rembrandts rarely come to market, but a pair of plausibly authentic portraits sold for $14.2 million in 2023, and 18 months earlier, the Dutch government, in association with the Rembrandt Association and the Rijksmuseum, had paid a whopping $198 million for a bona fide self-portrait. Art authentication efforts move slowly. Broadly accepted conclusions can remain evasive. And so, while more time is needed to determine whether Shorer had found an actual Rembrandt, he and whoever he outbid weren't alone in considering it genuine. Volker Manuth, the lead author of the Artist 29 Catalogue Raisonné, wouldn't offer a categorical answer, but, as he told me, it is very likely that it has been painted by Rembrandt. That same conclusion was reached by Manuth's esteemed predecessor, Abraham Bradius, whose landmark 1935 survey of Rembrandt's complete paintings included the portrait as study of a man with a swollen nose. Regardless, Shorer's putative Rembrandt hadn't been heard of since World War II, and yet, unlike many paintings looted by the Nazis, this one, with proper papers in tow, had been smuggled to the U.S. from Europe as the war broke out. The portrait was then sold, legally, to the chairman of Velcro companies. In short, its provenance appeared spotless. The painting fell into dormancy after being donated to a Benedictine monastery in California. In the intervening decades, it nearly went up in flames in two separate forest fires. When rescued from the first blaze, one monk asked the other, who'd snatched it off the wall at the last second, "Why did you take that?" The brothers dismissed the idea of it being an honest-to-God Rembrandt as laughable, so they finally ended up consigning it to an auction house. The monks had appraisers weigh in, only to be told the work couldn't possibly have been by the master. After his winning bid, Shorer brought a high-end 3D reproduction of the painting to the monastery as a donation. The surviving monks there were still in a state of semi-shock over the fact that they'd unwittingly owned such a pricey work. Shorer told them he'd found an eyelash in the impasto and was testing to see if its DNA matched Rembrandt's. He was not, however, aware of any genetic databases he could check it against. Either way, probing into it seemed to matter more to him than solving the problem. Working with old masters gets philosophical at times. Attaining a clear resolution isn't always possible. In art, some questions can't be answered. As Shorer says, using a musical metaphor, they simply hang out there in the ether as a chord unresolved. He doesn't tend to dwell on such perplexities. He just moves on to the next case. Investigating the unseen in the twilight hour is how I enjoy spending my life, he explains. After dinner at the monastery, he confided to me that he had come to a realization. His pursuit, in effect, was a never-ending quest for some kind of religious illumination that he knew might never come. The hunt for the lost Avrakamp continued into Master's Week and Master Drawings New York in January 2023, auctions and gallery shows featuring old works. More on the Avrakamp saga shortly. At that point, Shorer unveiled his Rembrandt at an invitation-only cocktail reception on the Upper East Side. Elegant guests streamed in, some wearing oversized scarves, others with glittering cufflinks. Mayfair accents could be heard over voices speaking German or Dutch. Shorer, sporting a royal blue suit with matching sneakers, winkingly and self-deprecatingly introduced himself to new arrivals as a research assistant. For the occasion, he'd hung his recently acquired 1629 portrait next to a self-portrait made around the same time by Rembrandt's dashing friend and competitor Jan Leavens. Their early works can be almost impossible to tell apart. The Leavens was on loan from Theodore Roosevelt's descendants. Shorer had been at a wedding in their home when he recognized Leavens' face on the wall. "I found it in the foyer," he told me. "I went around asking, who is the proprietor? The last time it was mentioned was decades ago. I don't think it has ever been on public view." At the reception, a professorial man in a bow tie took in the display, rapt. "I'm having a moment," he gasped. "This Leavens hasn't been seen in over a century, and Cliff found it at someone's house." He was Lloyd DeWitt, a co-author of Jan Leavens, A Dutch Master Rediscovered, and at the time, chief curator at Virginia's Chrysler Museum of Art. "The Leavens," DeWitt added, "was very, very shocking to see. This one wasn't even catalogued or known." By placing the supposed Rembrandt portrait next to one by Leavens, Shorer was trying to accomplish two things. First, to show an undisputed work compared to a disputed one from the same moment in time. Second, to show how his ability to unearth sleepers can play a deeper role in scholarship. There was also a degree of showmanship to the scene. He was doing it, he said, to throw meat to the wolves. Inquisitive visitors admired Shorer's find. Whether by Rembrandt or not, it depicted a wizened man with a bulbous nose, wispy facial hair, and downcast eyes, his sad thin lips parted in mid-sigh. He appeared to be homeless or a beggar. A tramp, someone suggested. The brushstrokes were loose and casual, in Rembrandt's signature experimental style, but the artist still captured the sitter's essence, his burden of worries, his frailty. Not long after the vernissage, a vetting committee designated the portrait as attributed to Rembrandt, as opposed to simply by Rembrandt. This meant that not everyone was convinced about its veracity. Shorer clarifies that their decision is not permanent and can be revisited in the future. The committee may have been erring on the side of caution. When Shorer sought to poll delegates to find out who the detractors were, some present allegedly cautioned him that he was being strident and obnoxious. According to one witness, an attendee piped up in Shorer's defense, "He's just enthusiastic. He's not strident." Whatever his attitude may have been, it's hard to encapsulate an individual as singular as Shorer. During our first phone call, when I had proposed writing about his art hound accomplishments, he responded, "I'd like to be the furniture, if I may." I laughed, not quite understanding. Then, over the course of our meetings, I came to realize what he meant, a protagonist in the background, more or less unnoticed. The fact is, however, he is hard not to notice. In person, Shorer's 6'1" frame is offset by a slight hunch, creating the impression of someone prepared to pounce at any moment. A polymath, he balances his erudition with a sardonic, arcane sense of humor. When I told him I found a particular art historian's style to be purple, he corrected me. Lavender is his prose. It is dancing off the poppies. Largely unaccustomed to publicity, Shorer seemed reluctant when I initially suggested I follow one of his ongoing cases, specifically the Worcester heist, with its alluring Averkamp. Shorer was also firmly reticent at first about sharing personal information. Given his keenly developed sense of sight, he struck me as both wanting, and wanting not, to be seen, to be the kind of furniture that's on display in a glass house. It was only after I pointed out that Arthur Conan Doyle's tales tend to start on Baker Street, the gumshoe Holmes, sitting in front of the crackling hearth, lost in thought and puffing on his pipe, that he finally agreed to have me over to the Gropius house. I arrive on a misty September Monday in Provincetown. A hurricane has just blown by, leaving charcoal-hued rain clouds in its wake. Shorer's glass home rises above the bay where the Mayflower first stopped in the New World. A verdigris plaque at his front gate commemorates the Pilgrim's Landing historical site. He and Chris bring me into their living room, where Shorer likes to do investigative work. Birch logs lie in the marble fireplace, strictly for decor. Their 60-ton geothermal system regulates the interior temperature year-round. Chris recalls the moment when Shorer first opened up about the Averkamp discovery. He came to me and said, "I found this painting on a pillowcase." I was like, okay, now he started finding them in his mind. "It was already in the rearview mirror 14 seconds later," Shorer adds. "I wanted to find out where the other missing paintings had gone." The paucity of paintings on display in their home is striking, suggesting that the art is secondary to the pursuit. But there is another consideration. The walls, after all, are primarily glass panes. The house itself is the artwork, Shorer insists. Gropius and his architect's collaborative partners had conceived of the dwelling as a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art. Everything from the doorknobs and cabinets to the retractable wooden panels that conceal the TV and hi-fi were custom designed. Frank Sinatra is said to have performed on the living room Steinway at the housewarming party 6 decades earlier. Shorer's paintings, he and Chris explain, are mainly kept off site, in storage, or on loan to museums. There are, however, a number of sculptures of ancient gods scattered about. A large Song Dynasty statue of a deity, a troop of Egyptian figurines, including an Isis and an Horus, a 17th century sculpture of Poseidon conquering the waves, a gift from FDR to Churchill. Shorer mentions nonchalantly that he'd acquired it in 2020 when he helped auction off the contents of the Waldorf Astoria. We make our way into the dining room, where I meet the couple's two purebred Rottweilers, Tyson and Nikki, whom they call their kids. Chris recommends not attempting to pet them. As we sit together, I say I'm hoping to understand how an autodidact such as Shorer has come to operate in such rarefied spheres. The dogs glower in my direction. But Chris encourages Shorer to speak candidly. "Open your feelings, for the love of God, Cliff." Shorer had a difficult childhood. His parents, neither particularly interested in art, separated when he was a boy. Their divorce litigation lasted years. Often in the care of grandparents, Shorer became precociously independent, spending much of his time alone in Boston. "I was on my own as of 11, he explains. His father, Clifford Scharrer, Jr., an entrepreneur and professor at Columbia Business School, corroborates this account. Cliff very early on decided to take care of himself, he tells me. He didn't want the conventional kind of parenting or to be part of the family nest. His father recalls that the teenage Cliff would disappear for days on trips to Manhattan. Once, when asked where he'd been, he claimed to have spent time hanging with Andy Warhol. His father didn't believe him, but then Warhol himself called the house a few days later. The guy is dinner and a show, Cliff Jr. says of his son. After Scharrer dropped out of high school, he started coding. Some of the software he wrote made him $27,000. When he was 17, he founded Bottom Line Exchange Company, which purchased items, mainly computing equipment and office furniture, that other companies needed to move. To make ends meet, he drove a taxi. Branching out, he bought a soon-to-be-bankrupt database company that was selling its whole operation for the price of its only real equity, two Xerox photocopiers worth $6,000. When Scharrer inspected the facility, he noticed an old 25,000-square-foot UNIVAC computer. While the owner didn't think it was worth much, Scharrer, a hardware geek, knew it contained 24-karat gold parts. The company also had 170 employees who had to be laid off. Scharrer, though only a teenager, did so. He then hired a team to disassemble the UNIVAC and strip out the gold. We ended up getting $67,000 or $70,000 from the gold, he recounts. I was well on my way at that point. When the computer manufacturing bubble burst in the late 80s and early 90s, Scharrer found himself snapping up failing companies and their real estate. He went on acquisition sprees, hoarding assets. At one point, by his estimate, the warehouse facilities for what he called his crazy catastrophe of storage took up 1 million square feet of space. He also invested in construction ventures and fast food franchises, funneling his profits into a bottomless passion for art. Scharrer started becoming a serious collector in his early 20s, focusing initially on Chinese porcelain. He amassed and sold hundreds of pieces at auction. After a trip to Paris, he began getting into Baroque paintings, which he researched in Harvard's libraries. Auction houses, before the internet, mailed listings of offerings there. In time, one sleeper led to another, even as his entrepreneurial projects snowballed, but all of them, on some level, connected back to his childhood. Scharrer's interest in art began at age 6, with a children's book called From the Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. In it, two young siblings run away from home and hide in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The book treats art as something to escape into, whether from loneliness, boredom, or an unhappy family life. As a child, Scharrer loved the Met and the American Museum of Natural History, which kindled an obsession with paleontology. This obsession reached its zenith in 2008, when Scharrer spent $942,797 for the nearly complete skeleton of a 23-foot-long triceratops from North Dakota's Badlands. A New York Times op-ed denounced the fact that a 65-million-year-old dinosaur specimen had somehow ended up in private hands. He eventually found a home for it, in a combination gift and sale, at the Boston Museum of Science, stipulating that it be listed as having come from an anonymous donor and that it be named Triceratops Cliff, after his grandfather, Clifford Scharrer Sr. The name is the same, unfortunately, so people know who it is, said Scharrer, again wanting to have it both ways, seen and unseen. At times, the dizzying extent of his exploits can seem to defy credulity. Even so, all the curators and insiders I have consulted for this story vouch for Scharrer. Some mention a propensity for exaggeration, or for conflating speculation with irrefutable fact. but Shorer merely seems to have figured out how the art business works. Frederick Ilkman, the Art of Europe chair at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, tells me that the institution, courtesy of Shorer, acquired three major European modernist paintings from Agnew's in 2023. Ilkman characterized Shorer as a brilliant, if eccentric, risk-taker, adding, "To be a good connoisseur, you have to be eccentric and take a risk." Part of his fascination with sleepers, which are, after all, bargain-priced items, seems to stem from a constitutional frugality. Chris emphasizes how Shorer's sole overarching interest is art, which means he doesn't care much for everything else. Clothing, food, even comfort. Despite his self-evident wealth, Shorer, during my Provincetown visit, suggests we meet for dinner at 4:30 p.m. to catch the early bird special. After the waitress informs us that the restaurant has stopped offering off-hours discounts, he vows never to return. Then, when we pile into his Prius, the stereo starts playing a podcast at such a rapid rate that I can scarcely make out the words. He says he likes listening to podcasts at 2.5 times speed, 4 times speed if the speaker has a British accent and talks slowly. Chris laments Shorer's proclivity for watching films at double speed. "Why waste 2 hours on a movie," asks Shorer, "if you can do it in one?" When the two of them first met, Chris thought Shorer was a spy. After their second date at the Cheesecake Factory, they walked to Shorer's townhouse in downtown Boston. At the time, it contained 120 large-scale old master's paintings. It was so creepy, Chris now recalls. It was like entering the Louvre. There were 4 floors of paintings. Everything was ancient. The religious iconography on display featured a preponderance of murders and martyrdoms. Crosses everywhere, nuns, you know, Chris says with a shudder. There wasn't an inch without a painting. Shorer still has many of these monumental canvases stored in warehouses. "I don't think I owned anything made after 1900, he adds, chuckling. "I wouldn't let anyone clean the townhouse. The bathroom had original 1851 fixtures. Velvet draperies covered the windows to keep sunlight out. The lighting scheme favored gas-burning sconces and candles. The overall effect was welcome to old ladyland," he beams, clearly proud of the anachronistic world he'd built. "We shouldn't live in the 17th century all the time," says Chris. Shorer disagrees, but the conversation reminds him of a line he'd written, "In the era of electric light, only the extravagant will burn tallow candles." It is derived from the narrative section of a symphony about Thomas Edison's life that Shorer co-composed for the Boston Pops Orchestra that premiered in 1997. When we settle in at the glass house, he proceeds to play us the 21-minute recording. A passage about grief, he notes, is autobiographical. "I could not let my personal pain distract me," recites the symphonic Edison, "for above all, time is my enemy." These verses reflect how Shorer has transformed the tallow of his own childhood into extravagant achievements. "Cliff cannot rest," Chris says, over swells of music as Edison proclaims his workaholic desire to continue exploring right until his funeral. "I think he always keeps working so hard because he's afraid he will be poor one day, like when he was young." "What psychology," counters Shorer, who points out that working on a project-by-project basis, as he does, necessarily differs from having steady income. Several months later, Shorer's patience was rewarded. He received an email from the daughter of the TEFAF gallerist. Attached was the bill of sale for the Avercamp. Armed with this new lead, he determined that in 1995, the painting had gone to a prominent Dutch family that had made its fortune in footwear. They'd purchased it legally as a work by Barent Avercamp. Shorer soon found their home on Google Earth, a big mansion and started sending letters demanding the paintings return to WAM in exchange for the amount they had originally paid at the long-ago art fair. The owners have requested anonymity. At first, Scherer thought he'd simply get the Avercamp back. After all, theft is illegal. Missing property ought to be returned. In the fine art market, however, what's right isn't always the same as what's legal. Looted works don't necessarily get handed over to their prior or lawful owner, as the Elgin Marbles attest. It's not fair that somebody gets to keep stolen art, but that's often how it works, says Aaron Thompson, professor of art crime at the City University of New York. Certain kinds of theft were long ago legalized by colonialist powers, allowing plundered objects and resources to enrich European nations. And while some countries and jurisdictions are evolving, others are not. Had the Avercamp been sold in America, odds are it would have already been confiscated by law enforcement. There are huge differences between the way people in the U.S. and in Europe approach the recovery of stolen art, notes James Ratcliffe, general counsel at the Art Loss Register, a London organization specializing in such transactions. In the Netherlands, even a thief can get title to a stolen artwork if they have had it for long enough. Conversely, American authorities have been aggressively enforcing restitution claims, even for decades-old cases. Last year, for example, New York's Antiquities Trafficking Unit seized and repatriated an ancient Anatolian bronze bust that had been in WAM's collection since 1966. The museum's experience with that bust would lead one to assume that the inverse would also hold true, that its own stolen goods would be returned swiftly. But Scherer's and WAM's legal team's retrieval efforts soon became mired in international art law technicalities. First, there were the owners of the painting. Rather than acknowledge receipt of Scherer's letters, he said, the family ignored them and lawyered up. Then, as his messages continued to go unanswered, he approached Dutch authorities, trusting that the police could seize it. To no avail. He wanted to involve Interpol, Scotland Yard, the FBI's art squad, but he says none could help. Growing antsy, he went public with the story. As reported in ArtNet News and Boston Magazine, Scherer threatened to initiate legal proceedings against the family if the painting was not returned within 40 days. That tactic didn't work either, but the media attention did bring another Avercampian individual out of the woodwork. Arthur Brand, a Dutch art detective who hosts a TV show in the Netherlands about tracking down and recovering hot artworks. Sometimes described in press accounts as the Indiana Jones of the art world, he'd made his name finding objects like Oscar Wilde's ring, Hitler's horses, and a missing Van Gogh. He told Scherer he wanted to help get the Avercamp back. Brand, having gleaned through news reports that a Dutch family had purchased the painting, contacted Scherer and offered to mediate. Because of his popular television program, he'd likely be more persuasive than Scherer. What I do is try to get paintings back that are stolen and which might disappear forever, Brand tells me. He contrasts this with Scherer's sleeper hunting, which, he points out, usually does not involve criminal spoils. The Avercamp overlaps between their respective areas of expertise, as well as their two continents' legal realities. Due to his status as a Dutch TV personality, Brand managed to communicate with the family. They were concerned, above all, with keeping their name out of the press. He advised them to do the moral thing and return the painting, on the condition that they not lose money on it. If they offer you such a deal, he counseled them, you should accept it. With Brand having wrangled the family to the bargaining table, Scherer and WAM's side offer to make them whole without allowing them to profit from the theft. This, despite the fact that the family, so Brand assures me, was well aware that their Avercamp was a real deal Endrick, and therefore worth significantly more than what they bought it for. But they would likely face difficulties if they ever tried to sell it. When the insurance company agreed to cooperate with the museum in order to get the painting returned, it seemed like a resolution might be close. Unfortunately, according to Scharer and Brand, the various sides then started haggling over taxes and other fees. Throughout the next year, as Scharer and Brand conveyed the fitful progress of the negotiations, I had to remind myself that a sleeper hunter, by definition, seeks value. Art is about beauty, but it's also a big money game. And business people don't get rich by compromising. They do so by chiseling. Development slowed to a trickle while Scharer spoke of pushing a very angry accelerator pedal. Seasons passed. I often thought of the forlorn-looking scrounger in his liminal Rembrandt portrait. Then suddenly, on Easter Sunday, 2024, I received a note saying that the two sides had come to terms. A year after originally planned, Scharer wrote. In the very next line, without pausing, he revealed that he was on to a new chase. "I've been contacted," he went on, "about a major Rubens presumed lost in World War II. I may drop all and go to Switzerland to see if it is real. Looks right." He was moving on to another adventure, but he was hopeful that the Avercamp would, in the end, return to Worcester. Regarding the other missing Stoddard paintings, Scharer says there are further morsels left on the trail that might eventually lead him to that quarry. He has started to sniff them out more doggedly. At the same time, he's still trying to get his recently resurfaced Tramp unanimously recognized as a Rembrandt, having co-written a book with Simon Worrall on the subject entitled The Lost Rembrandt. He's also begun spearheading an immense art restitution case involving a Leonardo, several Dürers, and more than 150 other foundational works of art in the Western corpus, on behalf of a Dutch Jewish bank dismantled by the Nazi regime. Scharer's efforts in the matter started coming to fruition this summer when he brought to market a Flemish Baroque work that had belonged to the bank until its liquidation in 1940, only to be presented as a birthday gift 2 years later to Adolf Hitler. Scharer describes this latest challenge as the first battle in the biggest war of my life. chic, please. Armani Ristorante presents a new way to savor the timeless appeal of a legendary name by Kayla Holiday, with illustration by Jay and Isley, which shows hands preparing a plate and a restaurant's interior. For Giorgio Armani, style goes beyond fashion. It is but one expression, and food is another. Just 2 decades after debuting his fashion label in Milan in 1975, Armani opened his first restaurant in Paris, the entree to an Epicurean empire that now serves carefully considered Italian cuisine in such glittering cities as Dubai, Milan, and Tokyo. This fall, Armani Ristorante will open its doors on Madison Avenue between East 65th and 66th Streets, where it will continue to prove, as the fashion designer once said, the only limit is good taste. Steps away from Central Park, the restaurant's contemporary space channels the decadence of a bygone era. A champagne bar greets guests at the entrance, giving way to marble effect flooring and mirrors on the walls. Just as Armani sees no virtue in creating impractical clothing, each restaurant seeks to adapt its cuisine to the locale. Executive chef Antonio D'Angelo previously worked as Armani's personal chef before becoming the corporate executive chef of the Armani restaurants in 2020. He hopes to capture the essence of the stately Upper East Side neighborhood through seasonal offerings that will distinguish the restaurant from Armani's former Fifth Avenue location, a swanky midtown spot that opened in 2009 above the Armani store. Its relocation and restyling at Madison Avenue will epitomize sophistication while staying true to the simplicity that is the hallmark of the Armani name. Among the 8 signature dishes that feature on select global Armani menus, you'll find Papa al Pomodoro, a ripe tomato and bread soup inspired by the traditional Tuscan comfort food with humble beginnings, elevated by the addition of buffalo mozzarella for a meal that's unpretentious and familiar. There will also be a savory Parmigiano-Reggiano risotto, served with a saffron fondue and adorned with a Giorgio Armani logo in fine saffron powder, that offers a refined twist on a Milanese classic. New York's own exclusive dish is a ravioli with Neapolitan short ribs ragu. Respect for the ingredients is a big part, says D'Angelo, who was born in Campania, through a translator. It's authentic, it's pure. That's the thing that's very Armani. You won't ever not recognize an ingredient that's on your plate. D'Angelo says he likes to wander the city, studying its environs and inhabitants for inspiration, essentially creating a local narrative for a restaurant. He compares the new location not to the Fifth Avenue restaurant that preceded it, he says, but to Tokyo, which has a similar fine dining philosophy. The architecture of the dish, says D'Angelo, is where you find the Armani essence, clean, pure, good at the moment. While our culinary preparations may be elaborate and artfully presented, my dishes always celebrate the inherent beauty of their ingredients, says Armani, who at 90 is as dedicated as ever to his vision of elegance. We'll be right back. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.